Today, I am joined by Mithras. He is an anonymous poster, a writer, and someone who I've been seeing coming up in the dissident right on the British side of our community. He's very insightful, and he's covered quite a lot of the more pressing subjects of the time, like Israel and Palestine, immigration, the evergreen subject on our side. Welcome.
Hi there, thanks for having me on. I'm sort of surprised you reached out in a way, because I just use Twitter as a sort of repository for my stream of consciousness. But it's nice for you to say that.
Well, I'm glad you come on, because there's not much of a more of a qualification that it's required to come on this show, except for me liking your tweets and thinking that you're insightful. I mean, the latest thing that I've read from you is your article on Israel and Palestine from the lens of someone who is in London, at least, or you've been to the protest marches in London. And I wonder if you could maybe start with that a little bit, because you've tested the water. You've seen the type and quality of people who are at these marches. I mean, what have you learned by walking the streets during the Israel and Palestine marches?
Well, the weird thing about the marches is they become this kind of regular feature of London life. You know, how there's like a sort of a rhythm of the city. Almost, they've sort of died down a little bit now, but basically every weekend the whole city center becomes turned over with, you know, Palestine demos, Palestine paraphernalia. Yeah, I did a tweet thread where I went to the rally, looked at it, watched it, and so on. I mean, there's so many layers to the whole Israel-Palestine thing. I mean, on one hand, I don't actually feel like the people demonstrating it's not an illegitimate manifestation of feelings in a vacuum. If you were to say these people have no legitimate reason to be out protesting or being angry. What it felt like though observing it was mostly like a demographic movement through the city, if that makes sense.
It's such a weird phenomenon, even from the dissident right perspective, because on the left, they're split about this. You know, you have kind of the Zionism versus, kind of up and coming Muslim identity. And then on the right, we're also split on this, because you kind of have this boomer Zionism, you know, the conservative love of Israel. And then you also have people who are whatever JQ pilled or have all sorts of other ideas. So it's very hard to kind of pin down what the position should be.
Yeah, the Israel-Palestine thing is, it basically turns everyone insane. Whoever engages with it on a really, really, it basically melts everyone's brains. So you've had this sort of weird dissection of the right. So I don't know if you're aware of Nick Griffin.
I've heard of him, but no, I don't know much.
Yeah, so when I was a kid, he was the British far right, and he was the former leader of the British National Party, and he actually achieved, I mean, he's not the most presentable looking man. If you were to kind of create a caricature of a far right person for the public, he would almost look like that. Like I think he has lost an eye in a shooting incident, and he just isn't a particularly PR, he isn't like a fresh faced PR kind of guy. But anyway, he was the main person on the British right. He got taken to court for basically raising the issue of grooming gangs before it all broke in the mainstream media. I think from memory, he was acquitted, but he was taken through the court system for doing that. And the reason he knew about the grooming gangs was the BNP was actually quite a grassroots movement in many ways. So it had a mass membership across the country, particularly in these places up north, that was these grooming gangs going on. And this is a bit of a tangent, but I will get back to the Israel-Palestine thing. Yeah, and then through that grassroots reaches the community, which to be fair, a lot of the right we have perhaps doesn't actually achieve that today. You know, he was aware of the grooming gangs issue before it got broke in 2012 with the Jay report into the political mainstream. But he was convicted of inciting racial hatred for raising that. But anyway, he won. They never became an MP, but he did stand in the seat of Keighley, which was a town that was very famous for grooming gangs and got a large percentage of the vote. But they did win MEPs. So I think it was a 20, off the top of my head, it was a 2010 or 2011 European elections. He won There was two MPs, him and Andrew Bronze. So then basically UKIP came in and took all those votes under Farage. But Farage is a lot more of a mainstream right-wing candidate, whereas Griffin was always on the British far right. Like, although he went to Cambridge, and I think his dad might be the Tory MP or something, but Griffin was always seen as a sort of beyond the pale character, whereas Nigel Farage is probably about as right-wing as you can go in the British political spectrum and not be completely cancelled, as it were. Then UKIP took most of those votes and ended up that sort of 5-6 year period before Brexit. Well, Nick Griffin has sort of reemerged weird, like he really just fell off the political spectrum from about 2012. But he sort of reemerged weirdly as in completely tweeting all the time about Israel-Palestine, completely obsessed with it. But he's weirdly, the weirdest thing is he's developed this kind of large Muslim following among young British Muslims who don't even know who he is. He was recently on the Five Pillars podcast with Dili Hussein, who's one of the most active Islamists in Britain, where they sort of had quite a lot. I listened to it. It was about 2 hours. I didn't disagree with everything Nick Griffin said, but it was like 2 hours of him basically having an agreement with Dili Hussein about where he even seemed to concede some ground on things like Griffin gangs. But it was just, he literally hates Israel-Palestine so much because he hates the Jews that much that it's almost, that is now his thing. And then, yeah, obviously you have the Conservative Party, which in recent years has become the British Conservative Party, which in recent years, since the 90s really, has just taken on without even really that much of an, the Israeli state will definitely try and influence British politics. There's no doubt about that. Like any country does that. I'm not saying there's a global conspiracy as such, but you know, it's rational for a country to do that. But obviously there is an Israel lobby in the United States with AIPAC, et cetera. That's obviously a thing. In Britain, it's a bit more of a like pound shop operation, but the British Conservatives have basically just become American style Zionists, really, more or less, which is weird because we always had a slightly uncomfortable relationship with Israel, really, because obviously the British mandate of Palestine was sort of something we ended up with after the First World War. And then it was one of those events that sort of just got completely out of hand and we ended up facing Jewish insurgency. I once met an old guy who was not an officer, a soldier at that time. And he absolutely hated Israel, which was actually quite common amongst the troops that served out there at the time, because one of their main threats was obviously being killed by Stern Gang or Ergun. So after all that, obviously we had the Arab Legion as well, which was British officer run, part of the Jordanian army, which captured the West Bank and East Jerusalem. So British, there's often this thing about the Balfour Declaration and like British, but Britain has always had quite a difficult relationship with Israel in many regards. The Yom Kippur War, we didn't arm Israel, unlike the US. The Queen never visited Israel, partly due to sensitivities with the Muslim world and the Commonwealth. But I think also the royal family, there's some quotes where they don't particularly seem to like Israel. There was always an Arabist part of the Conservative Party, which didn't want to upset Arab allies in the region too much, because obviously Britain has a lot of Arab allies there. But really since Thatcher was the first prime minister to visit, and then ever since then, and the Conservatives, yeah, we're an appendage of the United States, really, and where Washington goes, we've gone. And now that's captured both parties, even the Labour Party, which under its current incarnation is sort of, its current incarnation of Labour's foreign policy is to just shadow Joe Biden. So wherever Joe Biden goes, they'll go, basically. So yeah, on the right, you've got those kind of Nick Griffin people whose brains have almost melted with Israel-Palestine to the extent where they just can't talk about anything else. They've embraced loads of sort of third worldist positions. They can't talk about anything else. They're just obsessed with it. And then, which we might have a major global war or the region, you know, it is a major issue. It is something to be obsessed with. There's no doubt about it. But then you have people who are literally prepared to put Israel's interests ahead of national interest, which is the Conservative Party and to some extent the Labour Party. And also, weirdly, this is a political party that won't deport. For example, this week there was an Afghan man who threw acid at a toddler, and we found out that he had been applied for asylum twice, in the meantime being convicted of two sex crimes in Newcastle. Then after that conviction, been granted asylum, which then creates a 5-year pathway to becoming as British as me or, you know, anyone else. But this is the Conservative Party is a party that is willing to basically support an ethnostate in the context of Israel, which is a country that is, you know, pretty much prepared to do anything it sees as it has to do to protect its interests and preserve a demographic majority for what it sees as its people. But when it comes to domestic politics, the Conservative Party just won't even take basic steps to protect the British public. You know, like nobody in the world, and this is the weird thing, like, no, I don't think any Muslims in the global community would give a monkey's if we started deporting rapists, criminals, etc., who are British Muslims, whether they've got British citizenship or not. But our support for Israel obviously enrages loads and loads and loads of people. And it's all just so needless. Like, we don't need to go to Israel. We don't need to take all of the, I'm not saying you even need to take specifically pro-Palestine position, because it could well be a hopeless cause. I don't know. But yeah, we sort of, for no real reason, decided to affix ourselves to the Israeli mask. Yeah, and I suppose that, I think you're referencing an article I wrote where I was just trying to hope that the British right would find a middle position that reflected our status in the world as an island in Northern Europe, not one that would just shadow the Americans as much as possible, and one that also, I think, I also contrasted the fact that Israel basically is created out of a demographic shift. You know, there was an organized Zionist movement, but the way that Israel was created was just fundamentally about loads and loads of people arriving in a short space of time in an area and just taking it over. And they contested against the British authorities, which were weak, and they won. And, you know, it's a long history. You talk hours about Israel-Palestine. It's just literally an endless conflict. Yeah. In terms of the British Israel-Palestine stuff, it's just the main thing seeing the march is, it's not so much that I actually have a major objection with what they think. It's just more of an expression of, wow, there's this many people here in this country who probably don't really see themselves meaningfully as British, because you would see so many different flags. You see the flags of Pakistan to Bosnia to Turkey, you know, all of these different countries. You would see British flag. And it was just more like, wow, this is a manifestation of demographic power. And I think you do see that as well. If you go to a Muslim area in the UK, which the majority of the area might be from Pakistan or Bangladesh, you know, nowhere near the Levant, probably never even been there or anywhere near that region. Obviously, they're part of a global Muslim community, but the flag, they'll have the Palestine flag, some often affixed to the lamppost. You can see that in parts of East London, Bradford, and so on. Like, they'll be there. And it almost, if you ever go to Northern Ireland, that's also a similar thing. You'll drive around Northern Ireland and you'll see a British flag, Scottish flag, Northern Irish flag in a unionist area, and you'll see the Irish tricolour in a Republican area. It just feels like that, even like right down to the fact that they're attached to the lampposts. So it's almost domestically, I mean, on one hand, yeah, like a lot of people are dead. It's not like a non-issue, as opposed to these people are coming from nowhere, and since they've got nothing to be annoyed about, but actually it just feels more like an identity formation event for these people that have arrived in the country, and also more of a demographic mobilization more so than anything. And it almost reflects like modern European politics in a way, because you have tagged onto this a bunch of left-wing people for whom this group really doesn't really care that much about. Some of them maybe on the left, but the average person on the street isn't really caring about any of these sort of wider left-wing metapositions, which is also reflected in the national flags that are there. You know, I don't think they give a shit about Turkey being ruled by a right-wing Islamist, etc. So, yeah, it's an interesting topic.
It is, and I think the thing that I thought was really insightful there is exactly what you said about, you know, the fact that this is kind of almost a ritualistic participation and the forging of a new coalition that's kind of just finding its feet, kind of trying to recognize each other. Are we the same? Which is essentially kind of an anti-Western brown horde type coalition. You know, the classical left-wing segment is always represented there. You know, the weird, the loony boomers and the young kind of fringe lefties. But the bigger coalition there is Islamists of all stripes, which is kind of you know, as an Eastern European who's lived in the UK, I've lived in London for about 6 years. The importance of the not only Islamic but Islamist segment in the UK and the tolerance for it and the reverence for it is quite frightening and surprising. Like, there's not really many regions in the world that would have such a warm and neutral space for such a virulent ideology to bloom and fester. I mean, pretty much, but mostly fester.
Yeah, there's a meme about like location London, which has been picked up by say like American Muslims, who tend to be more, the American Muslims, for example, often do actually tend to be more very deep in the left-wing coalition, you know, signed up to all the stuff, BLM, LGBT, et cetera. Like, they're a bit more integrated in that regard, which has its own problems. So the meme is like location London, and it will be somebody, a London-based Muslim, just saying something completely outrageous, you know, some like insane Islamist thing that, and this is, I mean, Britain is pretty much the easiest country in the whole world to be an Islamist in, because you have, if you try and do this stuff in Egypt or Bangladesh, you know, Bangladesh, for example, has the Rapid Action Battalion, I think it's called, or Rapid Action Force, whatever. It, you know, these countries are, they see Islamism as a threat to state stability. You know, unless you're even the Taliban, I'm sure, keeps tabs on rival Islamic sects. The British state just doesn't really do anything. It's just the worst combination of factors, because Britain historically is a country that doesn't, you know, at least since the 19th century, the 20th century, doesn't really pay any attention to religious matters. It developed a culture of, you know, relatively high trust. Obviously, we'd had the Catholic-Protestant tensions throughout the early modern period, but really by the 19th and 20th centuries, you know, religion was not something that the state was involved in. It wasn't seen as a threat to state stability. The Northern Ireland conflict was more of an ethnic conflict than a religious one, to be honest, and also separated from the mainstream culture of England, where Islamism is most prevalent. And you have that combined with just the sort of apathetic cultural collapse of modern Britain, combined with a system that just really functions for a fairly high trust, fairly same culture society, which was this case until the early 90s, 2000s, where most people in Britain were just quite similar to each other. And I say all these stuff, arguments about free speech and so on, like these stuff really do necessitate some level of homogeneity, whether ethnic or cultural. And Islamism just manages to find its way in there, and there's no part of modern Britain that can really deal with that. And I think it also, the migrants that Britain has often attracted from the Muslim world are generally people from peasant backgrounds, essentially. So you've got Sylhetis from Bangladesh, which are hill villagers who came over to London. You've got Mirpuris, who are from a region called Azad Kashmir in Pakistan, who are mostly Pakistanis in Britain outside of London. These are people who are from basically very, yeah, like rural peasant backgrounds, who've then been put in the middle of modern, post-modern, secular, liberal Britain. Yeah, and I think just those combination of factors just create this horrible mess. But it's crazy. It's easier to be an Islamist in Britain than really any country in the Muslim world, as long as, you know, if you're not state-sanctioned Islamist. And it's probably easier to be an Islamist in Britain than it is in France or most European countries as well, because just the way that Britain's run, it doesn't do anything about it. And these people are just out there, you know, they've got whole congregations, it's a whole social structure, and they'll be living in places where they just really don't interact with a mainstream society. And I mean, that's the thing as well about the level of demographic change in some parts of the country, is if say you come to the United Kingdom and you come as a migrant on a visa, and even if you have an initial desire to actually integrate, the level of demographic change now proceeds so much that in certain parts of the country, often where you would go as a migrant, for example, Greater London, places like Birmingham, it would actually be genuinely quite hard in some areas to meet a native British person. So, yeah, I mean, I also like, yeah, I suppose it's, again, it goes back to the identity formation thing. When you rip people out, mass migration is a process that has an impact both on the host country in the sense of destabilizing it potentially, but also on the migrant and their descendants, as it can turn people a bit insane, I think. And you see that with maybe go the other way, the really, really woke diasporoid type person who just, you know, isn't maybe an Islamist, but goes the other way into sort of really embraces left-wing stuff, anti-Western, anti-white type thinking. But yeah, I mean, It's crazy because I know people, I know Saudis, I know people from Egypt, Jordan, Bahrain, etc. Like they're literally nothing like a lot of British Muslims. You know, British Muslims are their own breed. Yeah, interesting.
Oh, definitely, and it is interesting how the British left has kind of different levels of hatred for the culture prepared for these people. Like I know kind of middle class Muslims. And a lot of them have kind of graduated from the, first generation immigrant, striver, kind of still kind of Islamist culture of their parents to integrate into what is essentially kind of Novara Media type, you know, anti-white, anti-British culture, where they just kind of watch this, rage bait all day about how racist the UK is. And it's also, like you said, it's part of an identity formation where it's like, it's us against them, but, you know, we're also British, but we're a different kind of British. And I can imagine this is all very confusing for both the British and the, you know, second generation immigrants and everyone participating in this as an outsider.
It was insane about the British state, though, is that they brought in all these people who are, you know, from the Muslim world, and then they also will go out and support Israel really quite strongly. It just, none of it makes sense. And I know we had an MP this week complaining about his office being firebombed and him receiving threats. And it's like, well, what do you expect? Like, you've literally brought in loads and loads of people who are Muslim, and then you've supported Israel really strongly in a society with no guardrails really would prevent any, you know, we're not a police state, as not a terrifying police state, especially if you're from those communities. Like, you know, what do you expect? It's just, this is, the British elite is this kind of, I suppose from the outside, often people will think, oh, there's some like grand plan 40, 10D chess going on. It's like, they're just stupid, you know, none of this stuff makes any sense. And I mean, what were you just saying actually about the middle class Muslims? I mean, so London is more like a Muslim fusion pot. So you've got Muslims from all over the world that have gone there, and it's a huge number of different groups. Actually, outside of London, Muslims tend to be from Pakistan, and that's about it, more or less. So you've got this kind of weird, so yeah, okay, London, Birmingham, to an extent, you have Muslims from all over the world. Actually, outside of the country, a Muslim, the rest of the country, Muslim usually means from Pakistan, and they are often living in ultra segregated areas, particularly up in the north of England, parts of the Midlands, where, yeah, they're just sort of doing these completely, in a way, it's sort of comparable to Northern Ireland, but worse in a way. Obviously, there's not civil conflict in the scale of the Troubles, but more the cultural difference between the groups up there, which is white English, quite working class people, and then Pakistanis are this kind of, and they exist in this sort of by culture, it's not multicultural. Whereas London, it just is this like, yeah, it's this fusion of these people. And Islam, I think, you know, acts as a binding glue for them all.
Yeah. One thing that I think a lot of, you know, British people, Europeans in general, it's hard for them to comprehend kind of how much from the Arab world, especially, or people who kind of come from a Muslim background, how much the aversion to Jews is baked into the lore of just growing up there. I mean, I had a friend who was part Syrian, and it was a shocking thing. I mean, we weren't hanging out with anyone who was of any Jewish descent. I don't think he ever met anyone who was Jewish. They had like family lore. His parents were involved in like the conflict with Israel, or I guess his grandparents were involved in one of the conflicts with Israel back when they were still in Syria. There was, you know, this just this visceral aversion, and, you know, the like vermin type metaphors, and just it was really insane to witness, because, you know, I had absolutely nothing to do with this type of stuff. And then, you know, this person was absolutely normal usually. But then sometimes for no reason at all, the topic of Jews would come up, and then, you know, just like insane apocalyptic exterminationist metaphors would just kind of pop up, and I would just, you know, have this wide-eyed look, and, you know, the person would be like, okay, I'll cut it out, but you know that, you know, Hitler did a good thing and stuff. I was like, oh my God, please spare me. So
yeah,
quite interesting.
Yeah, I remember hearing a story about someone, a German NGO worker who went to the Middle East and would introduce herself as German, and people would be very sort of excited. And then eventually he found out, he was like, oh, they like Germany because of the football, the cars, and Hitler, which he obviously didn't like because he was an he was a sort of left-wing NGO guy. But I mean, it's just a pure ethno conflict, really. I mean, I think that's just how they work. If you have an ethnic conflict, which I think is Christopher Hitchens, he said they took the Israelis took the land from the Arabs, which is the most important, the land being the most important thing to the Arabs. So he said something like that. I can't remember really that quote, but yeah, it's just a pure ethnic conflict, and that's just what they look like. I mean, an unfiltered ethnic conflict just descends into that sort of phraseology. I mean, one thing that has been noted is obviously you've got all these controversies in Britain and America of things being said on, say, university campuses, you know, along those lines about Jews, and then, which, you know, I don't think anyone should be saying that, but what people have made the point is this has been being said for years on these campuses about the white majority of America and Britain, and nobody has really done anything. You know, like, we've heard all this stuff before. I mean, you know, sort of generalized anti-white rhetoric goes on these campuses, and it suddenly becomes a deal with the Israel-Palestine thing. But actually, this sort of like political extremism from the left is all over the place. And I mean, that's how I ended up in this political realm. Like, I don't think under other conditions I would actually be that right wing. I think it's just more a reaction to, I mean, for me, it was a reaction to COVID and being locked in the house. I mean, I wasn't a sort of extreme left wing or anything at any point, but, you know, it was a reaction to being locked in the house during COVID, which I don't think really needs loads of elaboration. I think your audience probably all agrees that was terrible. And I think no one was talking about COVID for hours. I mean, that was just awful. And seeing how the media operated, you know, how it shut things down, and getting into the sort of Curtis Yarvin's description of the cathedral was quite useful for explaining how just completely nonsense things about mask directives and stuff would just be transmitted vertically down to people. And then at the same time, it's been locked in my house, the whole BLM thing going on in London and the US, and just going, yeah, like, just thinking, this is insane. I'm not the insane person here. And I think, given that we're all locked in our houses and so on, social media was a good outlet to escape that. But I think once you start thinking, once your brain starts thinking in those ways, and you begin seeing the world in a different, I think once you begin integrating into these spaces and become like a pattern recognizer, as it were, you start thinking about other things, and it sort of all comes together a bit.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, the lens of elite theory and how status influences kind of all of these, you know, tribal perceptions, us versus them, it's been really fascinating to see. But at the same time, because I feel like it's very fueled by the conversation online and, you know, what identities people try to form, it's also not as, you know, like you said, this stuff has been going on for a while. It's escalating in terms of the discourse, like what people are saying is getting crazier and crazier. But in terms of actual, you know, I mean, street protests is about as far as it's gotten, especially lately. I mean, BLM protests were a bit spicier, but I guess that's a multifactorial problem there. It's extra spicy in the U.S. for demographic reasons. But I mean, the Israel-Palestine marches, I mean, outside of the identity formation ritual, nothing really comes of them. It's like, okay, people go out, they, you know, go to Waitrose, get some hummus, you know, hang out at the park, make some chants to the river, from the river to the sea, whatever, hang out with your friends and then go home. You know, it feels like every year there has to be some, you know, vector for seeing your friends at the park and also doing something, you know, some team building with them about whatever cause is du jour.
I agree. Although it would be interesting to see what happens with a large, cohesive Muslim voting bloc and whether they will disembark from the Labour Party, which may or may not happen. I don't know. I mean, Labour doesn't actually at this point probably need them to win, but it will be interesting to see. And I mean, I do think there's probably a slight difference between the Palestine March and the BLM March. Not that I particularly love the Palestine marches whatsoever, but I would say the BLM marches in the United Kingdom were absolutely ridiculous. Like the whole, there was no reason for them. It was just an outgrowth of what was happening in the US, just splurging over into the United Kingdom and happening on a on a slightly, a more minor scale, like they weren't burning down whole parts of cities like they were in the United States, but it was just a complete slop over. Because you even got those marches in places like Ireland and so on. I would say the Palestine marches, I mean, Britain is supporting Israel. Israel is killing a lot of people. So there is actually there is something there. I'm like, well, okay, there is a reason. Whereas BLM or Trans Lives Matter, this stuff just seems like completely astroturf nonsense. I do sort of get, although I just don't like seeing them. But also the British government has no, it's a completely incoherent position because it says broadly these marches shouldn't go ahead, but we're taking a core role or trying to take a core role in the conflict. So, you know, you can't, if you don't want these marches to go ahead, don't import loads of people. Because I don't know the exact figures, but the Conservative Party since 2019 is net migration has been higher than it ever has been in British history. So I assume, you know, of those people, some of them will be on that march. So, I think you mentioned a bit on elite theory, but I think Matt Goodwin talks about this a lot, and I like Matt Goodwin, but I do think the British elite are not an elite. They're really stupid. Like, this is a country that has no secure energy supply. It's a country that can barely run itself. It only functions because of decades or centuries of social capital. You know, the whole infrastructure of the country, about a fifth of the housing stock is built before World War One that we live in. You know, the railways that you use are Victorian, the sewage systems, the whole country is not run properly. This is not an elite. Like, it is an elite as such, but they're not very smart, and I don't think on the right we should be that. Although the British state is able to ruin people's lives and shut down people on the right. So you have to be careful to not make foolish mistakes, because they jailed someone this week for putting up some stickers about, you know, there's a guy, I don't know the full case, but he put up some stickers saying something like, white British will be able to, you know, just some writing stickers, basically. They weren't even explicitly racist. So they can do that, but the British elite are not that smart. I mean, look at Brexit. So although Brexit has been predictably sort of hijacked into like a nothing sort of slightly flaccid outcome, the people that actually caused Brexit were not like 9D chess players. They were just organized people on the right who wanted to leave the EU, but they weren't sort of intellectually that sharp. And I do think over the next 10, 20 years, there is going to be a cohort of people who are, I think the human capital on the British right has never been higher, and you don't need that many people to influence British politics. It's not the United States. The British political system is not that well fortified, as you saw with Brexit. They tried to shut it down. The fortification of the British system works by having a managed two-party system, but it's not the same as the Republicans or the Democrats. The US is a huge global empire. The United Kingdom, nearly, you know, it's more brittle than people think. And I do think people on the right shouldn't be so doomerist about all this stuff. And I do think we have an elite, sure, but they're not that impressive. Like the people who run the civil service, the people in Westminster, people in think tanks, and our journalists. We just need to have enough, and I think it's emerging, people on the right with human capital. And I think the situation will emerge. I mean, Britain is heading towards a ridiculously bad future on current trajectories relative to what people expect from living in this country. You know, it's not a place where people expect ethnocultural tension. You know, okay, maybe in the 70s people were a bit used to power cuts, but, you know, potentially, you know, blackout stuff I would caution against total doomerism that you see about Britain from some people on the British right. As bad as it is, if you are a doomerist and you think there's no hope, just stop it posting, because there's no point. Just give up and I don't know, go to the Isle of Eigg in Scotland, or go to the Isle of Lewis or something. I don't know, because I do think there may be a point where you have to go full doomerist, full Peter Hitchens, but like, I'm not in awe of the British elite. This is not a particularly well-fortified structure.
No, I agree. I think just to come into the defense of elite theory more generally, I think what is happening, I think what you have outlined as well, is that the British elite is not necessarily the supreme elite governing the UK. There is the center of the empire is far away, and they're essentially just executing, you know, directives from higher up, or like you said, the Labour Party is essentially in lockstep with Biden. People are imitating things that don't necessarily fit, like, you know, ridiculous BLM marches. Like, the status flows from an elite. It's not necessarily the elite on the ground. They're just kind of mimicking, you know, they're in the cave and we're two layers deep, you know, imitating the shadows on the wall. And I think that's also why it comes out so stilted and weird and non-representative of either the electorate and their wishes, or the state of the state of things on the ground, or demographic realities in the country. It's all very weird, and you know, this trickles down even to like Eastern Europe. Even here, the pattern of thinking is, you know, Republicans versus Democrats already. You know, even here, it's all kind of imitation of things that, you know, have no basis. Things here are very different, and they're even more different than they are, you know, between the UK and the US. I mean, this is not the Anglosphere. We've got people from the Balkans here. You know, it's not Pakistan, but you know, it's somewhere in between. So it's a very strange thing. But you can see like the effect of the center of power, where the status flows from, where, you know, the null hypothesis is set, is the center of the empire, is the, you know, that's kind of what, where elitism, the elite creed is emanating from. And yeah, it's a very weird situation to be in, because yeah, it just doesn't reflect much outside of whatever, you know, actually happens between the people who are at the top.
Yeah, it does shape, it certainly shapes cultural discourses for sure. I do think the UK is probably a bit less crazy than the United States on most issues. And I don't want to get into the whole trans issue because I find it a bit dull, but on say the turf stuff, you know, that was a weird thing where Britain was, although it had inculcated some of the trans, like copy and paste kind of phrases and thinking from the United States, it did have a domestic pushback of these TERFs, who are actually often like center left middle-aged women who'd work for trade unions and so on. So there are local currents that push back. I do think generally, even on the British left, as much as they're usually quite annoying and dangerous, they're not often quite as insane as some of the stuff you get around race in the US, which is just a country that is totally obsessed with race in a very weird way due to a number of factors. But in terms of, yeah, again, in terms of the British elite, I mean, the Labour Party, which you said, you're right, it is currently just shadowing Joe Biden, and it sees itself as, you know, on foreign policy, just copy and paste that. But I mean, that got took over by Corbyn. I mean, that was the most sort of incompetent, the stupid movement of people, but they got relatively close to actually winning political power in the country. So, I mean, if you talk to Corbynistas, they'll be talking about the centrists, Labour centrists sort of running them out of power, which is sort of true, but it's like, you know, you lost those guys, so you can't really be that upset, because these are, you know, people who are they're not really that impressive or smart. But what the point I'm making is that the Labour Party got took over that quickly. There is a brittleness to the British system that can be exploited, I think, because the US just has so many layers of power. We'll have to see what Trump does if he wins in 2024, and how he can somehow dismantle all of that, so make moves against that stuff. But the US power is very distributed, and it's quite hard to take things over. Although I suppose Trump's taking over the Republican Party. What I'm saying is the British power system can be subverted and taken over, I think, reasonably quickly if you wanted to. You had the ability to do so. It's just, yeah, just getting the things in place. So I'm not totally done. If I was totally doomerist about the country, I would just move to, I don't know.
Where does Peter Hitchens recommend that people move?
Well, yeah, well, he never recommends anywhere. That's the thing. Like, he never tells you where to go. And I've asked him on Twitter, and he never tells you. I'm not sure where he wants you to go, because all the Britain is often at the forefront of a number of negative trends, and it does take a particularly bleak view on just not in any way privileging its own citizens compared to even, say, the median European country like Norway or something. But most Western countries are experiencing these problems. Sorry, I've got a bit of a cold. Experiencing these problems on at least some level. So, yeah, I mean, there is an argument for fleeing, maybe. But, yeah, if you're to flee, I would say just go to the Arabian Peninsula and not pay any taxes. I don't know, but Peter needs to tell us where. You should have him on the show and ask him.
Yeah, I try
repeatedly to tell us where.
I try to invite him. I think I've got some leaders. I'll try to activate them and get him on the show. Yes, I think I think isn't that Babs theory that, you know, in times like these, it's better to purely inhabit the role of the expat. You know, you're kind of, none of the governments really want to get you, essentially. That's, you can rest and kind of exist in kind of the shadow realm where people really don't care about you, but they appreciate your whatever Substack money or.
Well, I think after the Norman conquest, Anglo-Saxons started going to Constantinople to work as bodyguards. And I think there's also a historical theory that they colonized parts of Crimea, created a kind of Anglo-England offshoot for a bit. So yeah, maybe small scale colonies of people. But I mean, yeah, I know all that stuff about escaping the First World and then going to, I mean, that's all Andrew Tate thing, isn't it? Going to Romania and then, but don't broadcast it.
Then going to jail.
Because he broadcast that Romania was corrupt and ended up in jail. So he put a target on his back through his actions and also by telling everyone Romania was corrupt. Come here, because they won't arrest you.
I don't know exactly. I think it's a strange one with Andrew Tate. Just knowing kind of the circles he travels in Bucharest, it's definitely quite unsavory. People who have been in jail and are in and out of jail for all sorts of reasons are his homies. So,
well, don't be an expat and do all that stuff.
No.
Definitely don't badmouth the police of the country hosting you, because that will certainly, even in a corrupt country, there's usually wheels turn to deal with someone doing stuff like that, isn't it?
Exactly. And to be honest, since we've had, you know, the European Union, as much as people are justified to not like it in the UK, for places like Romania, it's really been an important, you know, vector to align us to some sort of norm of, you know, I mean, corruption's really plummeted since we had to align with EU norms. But I've talked about this before on the show, and, you know, it's a weird one. You know, the EU is yeah, it's a mixed bag depending on where you live.
Yeah, I mean, if you have an insanely corrupt state that just doesn't function, then a technocratic void, like as described by Peter Mayer, probably could be an improvement in some way.
It is, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know where long term that ends up.
Exactly.
But,
yeah.
And also,
yeah.
I mean, Brussels has its own corruption, but yeah.
Yeah, I think it's good at, you know, stamping out things like, you know, just people bribing and, you know, because of just the fact that you need to show papers, you need to show supervision. There's just more attention from a higher order organization on everything you're doing. And there's a lot of structural funds that are coming in, and then you essentially have to, you know, prove exactly what you're doing with them. It just you can't be corrupt while involving EU money. So it's kind of really, yeah, it's been good. But yeah, I mean, elections here, I would say fairly fair at this point, especially comparing them to, you know, the early 90s or, you know, post-communism. It was a shit show, very much a Wild West, you know, all the old communists would, you know, they would go into the villages and you know, bribe people to vote for them with, like, giving them cooking oil and stuff like that. That was the old way. Now, I think, you know, just the need for transparency has lifted a lot of the you know, the
well, at least they gave you cooking oil, because if you're on the right, if you're a right-wing person and you're young in Britain, the Conservative Party will give you literally nothing.
True.
I mean, politics is patronage, but the Tories, like, there is no reason to vote for them. I mean, they're not right wing anyway, but they look, it's a patronage party for pensioners, essentially. So, I mean, I would vote for a communist Eastern European giving me cooking oil over the British Conservative Party, I think.
Yeah, I mean, that's the grim note that we'll probably have to wrap on, because I'll have to go see to the babies. But I have to ask you the last question of the show. Everyone gets this one. And it's, do you have a recommendation of a subversive thinker, could be a writer, could be any sort of character that you found interesting that you think the listeners might find interesting as well?
Yeah, I think because we talked a lot about ethnic identity and ethnic identity formation, there's a book by, I might get his name wrong, I think he's Dutch, called Pierre van den Berg, called The Ethnic Phenomenon. He's actually a leftist. I think he's written it from a Marxist perspective, but he talks about the real reality of common descent and ethnic groups. And I mean, he writes from the perspective of wanting to both sort of identify that as a reality and trying to not make it such a big thing. But it's an interesting book because it does describe, like what you're saying, what we've described about, you know, and I think some of the stuff we're describing, and I think it's also useful for anyone in the UK to read, because I just think our politics will become more ethnocentric, or I don't know, it's hard to imagine Britain in 20 years exactly when there is no single ethnic group that forms the majority of the population, but I think that book will help you understand potentially what it might be like, you know, people voting around their identity, organizing around their identity, primarily identifying through their identity, and then with this nominal British nationality sitting atop that.
Yeah, I haven't heard of this writer before, and yeah, I mean, this is very much a useful manual for whatever is to come, pretty much everywhere.
Yes, it's a manual, and it's available via PDF. I've sent it to a few people. It's quite popular on our side of Twitter, aka Inc. British-based, about 50 British-based accounts. They've all read it or are aware of it, but I would recommend others read it. It's a very good book.
Oh, nice. Okay, perfect. Thank you so much. I'm very glad that you came on, and I want to point people to your Twitter account. It is at HardTimesHere11. I'll put it in the show notes. Is there any other?
Yeah, I don't know why it says that, actually. Sorry, go on.
It's as good as any.
When I was making the account, I just chose that. I'm not sure why. Probably in my head.
Yeah, it doesn't really matter. So people end up with all sorts of, you know, like, look at the 0HP Lovecraft handle. I mean, it's fine. And is there any other place that you want people to check out or anything they want?
No, that's, I mean, just follow me. That's fine.
Excellent.
Hopefully mildly interesting.
Oh, definitely. Very interesting. You wouldn't be on the Subversive Podcast if it wasn't the case. At least I like to think so. Thank you so much. And yeah, see you on the interwebs.